Donald Lehrer has spent a lot of time in the lab of a Nobel Prize-winning neuroscientist. Now he spends his days at a computer keyboard telling the rest of us what he's learned. Lehrer has written for The New Yorker, The Washington Post, and The Boston Globe. And he's the author of two books, Proust Was a Neuroscientist, and now How We Decide. When Steve Paulson talked with Jonah Lehrer, he wanted to know more about the biological mechanics of making up your mind.
Can you pinpoint particular parts of the brain that control our decision-making process?
The most discrete system is the quote-unquote rational brain, and that's a fold of flesh in the frontal lobe called the prefrontal cortex. It's often referred to as uniquely human brain area.
The thing that supposedly distinguishes us from the rest of the animal world.
This is the Promethean bit of the brain. It takes up about a third of our brain, consumes about 45% of energy in the brain. You know, it does a lot of the heavy lifting. And it's been greatly expanded in human evolution. So that's partly what makes the human skull so funny-looking, is that it had to make room for this ever-expanding bit of flesh at the front. It's just behind the forehead. So that's the rational brain. When you think in clear, deliberate chains of logic, when you consciously make a list of pros and cons in a decision, when you compare prices, when you do all these things that we think about as, you know, putting in the rational category of decision making, that's the bit of brain you're using. It's also important for things like self-control, impulse control. So when you see something delicious, but you know you shouldn't eat it because you're on a diet, this is the part of the brain that we also rely on. So yes, humans are capable of reason, but you know, evolution didn't design a perfectly rational brain. So because the prefrontal cortex has to do so many different things, from think deliberately to hold stuff in working memory to exert self-control, it's often short-circuited. We often ask it to do too much because the fact of the matter is this bit of the brain is actually pretty profoundly limited. It can only handle about 7 pieces of information plus or minus 2 at any given moment. You give it more than that, and you start to short-circuit it. One of my favorite experiments of the book is a really clever one done by Babashev at Stanford University, where he brought two groups of undergraduates into his lab, and he gave one group 2 digits to remember to. The other group he gave 7 digits to remember to. He told them this was a test of long-term memory, but he was actually lying to them. He then marched him down the hall and gave the two groups a choice of chocolate cake, you know, gooey, rich, decadent slice of chocolate cake, or a responsible fruit salad. And what he found was that the group given 7 digits to remember was actually nearly twice as likely to choose the chocolate cake. And the reason he argues is that those 5 extra numbers took up so much processing power in your prefrontal cortex that you didn't have enough, you know, processing power left over to actually exert self-control.
That, you could interpret this a very different way, which is maybe the chocolate cake was just better. Why not choose that?
You know, I think one competing hypothesis, the people who had to remember 7 digits felt like they deserved it. Like, like they just done this really hard thing, and so they deserve the chocolate cake. But I think, you know, the nagging gap, I mean, this obviously builds on a larger body of work demonstrating how cognitive load, that's the fancy word for basically stretching the amount of information you can cram into your prefrontal cortex, into your rational brain, how that can really skew our decision making. You know, this is a particularly clever example of that. So obviously there are competing hypotheses to explain this funny result of why giving people 5 extra numbers makes them so much more likely to choose chocolate cake. But I think the same thing applies when after a long day at work, we're kind of run down. Our prefrontal cortex is probably a little drained of glucose. We're just tired. Why that's when we're most likely to, you know, order the pizza, eat the whole pizza, and then have some Haagen-Dazs.
Well, but I guess the other question is whether we need to distinguish between how we make decisions and how ideally we should make decisions, and whether the should part is that necessarily more rational? I mean, do we make better decisions if we're sort of, you know, doing all of the heavy lifting with this prefrontal cortex part of our brain?
I mean, one of the other things that draws me into this research is that I think inevitably the questions of how we make decisions become prescriptive questions, become, well, how should we make decisions? It's not simply a matter of let's learn about the brain for all sorts of abstract intellectual reasons. This kind of knowledge can be instantly applied to shopping for cereal in the supermarket. In terms of the question about should we always be rational, I think the easy answer is absolutely not. I think one of the things you learn when you look at prefrontal cortex is, given its intrinsic limitations, given the fact that it can do many wondrous things, it can exert self-control, but it's also very, very limited, very bounded. This has led many, many scientists to conclude that actually, and this is a pretty counterintuitive finding, but actually it's the really hard problems in life that we should not be rational about, that we should actually be emotional. And
what kinds of problems?
One of the experiments that demonstrates this was done by researchers at the University of the Netherlands. And they gave people a number of cars to choose from. In one condition, they had four different cars to choose from in both conditions. But in one condition, each car was rated in four different categories. So 4 times 4 equals 16 total pieces of information. And so they gave people all these cars rated in terms of trunk space, horsepower, fuel economy, the big categories, stuff like that. One car was objectively ideal, so it really was the best in all the different categories. And what you find is that in this simple condition, when people made a rational decision, they tended to find the best car. So you give them a minute to look over the options, they think it through, they assess all the information, and when they're allowed to be rational, they make the best decision. And that's pretty obvious. That's what we all kind of assume should happen. Plato would be satisfied with the result. In the second category, each of the four cars was now rated in 12 different categories for a total of 48 pieces of information. So now, this is a much harder decision. There's a lot more information there. It also happens to be much more realistic, right? Because when you go to buy a car, there's lots of stuff to think about. I mean, it's not just fuel economy and horsepower. It's trunk space, analog brakes. I mean, how you feel about the interior. There are a million different variables. And so what these researchers found is that in the hard condition, when you ask people to be rational about it, when you gave the information, let them sift through it, they actually found the best car less than 25% of the time. So they're performing worse than random chancers. So this clearly, I think, demonstrates the limits of the rational brain. But then they did something else, which is pretty clever, where they had people look over these options pretty quickly, get the information into their head, then they distracted them with a word puzzle for the next 20 minutes. So these people couldn't be thinking about the cars because they had to be solving this silly little crossword puzzle. Then after 20 minutes was up, they said, quick, pick the best car. And now, because these people had to use their unconscious, the first response was, well, I have no idea what the best car is. They said, well, just go with the car that feels the best. So now they're trying to access the emotional brain. And now you find people are able to find the best car in this hard condition. These are the distracted people using their emotional brain about 55% of the time. So what this suggests is that in these harder conditions where we might overwhelm our rational brain with information, the emotional brain can actually make better decisions. And that's simply because it can take in more information. It can process more information. And so that's led some people to kind of reassess the virtue of the emotional brain.
What do you mean when you talk about the emotional brain?
Unlike the rational brain, it's not a discrete bit of brain. It refers in general to a bunch of brain areas in the midbrain, everything from the nucleus accumbens to the amygdala to the ventral striatum. These are areas that tend to be saturated in dopamine, so they respond to pleasurable rewards like sugar and sex and cocaine, stuff like that. And they're brain areas that in general we share with lots of other animals. So they're not particularly unique to the human brain. But what you also find in the human brain, which is I think pretty interesting and a little counterintuitive too, is that a big part of the prefrontal cortex, actually its job is to monitor the emotions.
So it's not just the seat of rationality.
It's not just the seat of rationality in the sense that a big part of what rationality seems to have been built out of, is constructed on and depends on, are these very visceral primal emotions that we often can't explain, that we don't know where they came from. And I think the other important thing to say about the emotional brain is a lot of its processing is unconscious. So we're often besieged by these emotions where we can't explain why we're feeling what we're feeling. We have no idea why we're upset or why this particular option seems so alluring to us. And yet I think what our emotions are often trying to tell us is that they've done the processing, they've processed information, they've taken into account, and our emotions in this sense are kind of a window into the unconscious. The brain's trying to share one of its secrets.
Now, on the other side of the spectrum, I guess you could say, you talk about the New England Patriots quarterback, Tom Brady, who is not the most gifted athlete in the world. In fact, he was rated very poorly when he was first drafted in the NFL because he doesn't have the strongest arm.
He's a great scramble.
He's a great quarterback, as we all know, and he's most famous probably for keeping his cool under fire and making great decisions in a split second.
Well, when you read the original college scouting report on Brady, he was drafted in the 7th round, I believe. You know, it's like 500 words of just harsh criticism. Too skinny, bad arm, can't scramble, awkward footwork, blah, blah, blah. And then at the very end, they, on the positive side, the only thing they list is intangibles and decision making. I think he's always had a bit of talent for finding the right receiver. But I think, I mean, what we really talk about when we talk about great quarterbacks is the ability to choose the open man, is the ability to scan their options very quickly. You know, you've got 3.5, 4 seconds to check off, you know, if you're running a modern offense, 4 or 5 different receivers. So that means each receiver, you've got to assess lots of different variables, the location of the cornerbacks, the linebackers, all these different things you have to take into account. Where's the defensive lineman? Am I going to be sacked? Taking all these variables, process it very quickly, and then make a decision, you know, often in very stressful circumstances. I know if a 350-pound lineman was chasing me, I would just fall into a fetal position. I wouldn't be able to actually throw the pass to the tight end.
So it raises a question of, is there something that's happening in his brain that's different from the run-of-the-mill quarterback?
Well, yeah. And I think the first question is, how is that even possible? And I think you find something very interesting when you ask quarterbacks, well, how did you make that decision? And uniformly, what they all say is, I don't quite know. It just felt right. It just felt like the right guy to go to. And then quarterbacks are, in a sense, a model of emotional decision-making. They demonstrate what our emotional brain is so gifted at, which is taking all this information into account. You're just scanning the field very quickly. You're seeing stuff out of the peripheral vision. You probably have no conscious awareness of where the safety actually is. And yet, based on these fleeting feelings, you're able to make these very quick and effective decisions. So I think that is how the best quarterbacks do it. I think often one of the challenges for quarterbacks, especially young quarterbacks, and I think Eli Manning's a demonstration of this, is these are guys who come to the NFL with very high Wunderlich scores. That's the IQ test the NFL gives to QBs and place a lot of emphasis on. These are guys with, you know, the highest scores, and yet they often struggle a lot. And I think part of what they're struggling with is learning how to trust their instincts, learning how not to take too much time in the pocket.
So when you're talking about, say, how a good quarterback, really taps into his emotional brain, are you talking about intuition here?
Well, I think that's another one of the interesting themes to emerge from the science of decision making is I think there's been an increasing understanding that we've got all these different words, instinct, intuition, emotion, feeling, and they're really all, from the perspective of the brain, they're all really synonyms. Mm-hmm. That often what we talk about when we're talking about intuition, we're talking about feelings. These are feelings that may not be very strong. They may not be a raging anger or this raging desire, but they're often these very subtle emotions that drive our decision making. And it turns out that even when people don't think they're experiencing an emotion, if you measure the electrical skin conductance of their hand, for instance, which changes when we're slightly nervous or slightly excited, you can actually detect these unconscious emotions, which are driving our behavior.
John Allaire is the author of How We Decide. He talked with Steve Paulson.